This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Absolutely, check them out.
Yeah, so, you know, when you talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of precision, like engineering or something. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points and says, you know, there it is, broken.
Right, it's binary. It's comforting, honestly. We like things to be visible, to be categorized neatly into boxes.
Exactly. But then you step into the world of financial regulations. Specifically, we're talking about the FINRA communications with the public rules today, and suddenly that x-ray machine is just totally broken.
Oh, completely broken.
We're looking at a regulatory landscape that is, well, honestly, it can feel incredibly murky if you don't know what you're looking at. And since you are studying for the Series 82 exam right now, you are about to learn the rules that govern basically everything a rep writes, says, or hands to a prospect.
Right. All of it. Before a single dollar ever changes hands.
Exactly.
It is the absolute definition of regulatory muddy waters for a lot of professionals. Because, I mean, it's not just about what you say. It's about who you say it to, how many people you say it to, and when you say it.
Which is a lot to juggle.
It is. The Series 82 exam loves to test the boundaries of these rules. But the secret to this entire unit is really understanding the underlying rationale, like the paper trail.
The why behind it all.
Exactly. FINRA isn't making rules just to, you know, create administrative torture, though it feels like it.
It definitely feels like it sometimes.
Right. But they're actually trying to protect specific types of people from specific types of harm. If you know the why, you don't really have to memorize a giant list. You just follow the logic.
I love that. And to help us visualize this, to pull it out of that abstract textbook language and into the real world, we are going to rely on a recurring cast of characters today.
Yes, the hypotheticals are crucial.
We really need to ground this stuff. So I want you to meet your new best friends for the next hour. First up, we have Riley the Rep.
Good old Riley.
Yeah, Riley is an overeager, well-meaning, but occasionally careless Series 82 representative. He just wants to close some deals, make some commissions, and sometimes his finger hovers over that send button a little too recklessly.
The industry is full of Rileys, to be honest. They aren't malicious. They just prioritize speed over compliance.
Which is a dangerous game. Next, we have Ingrid the Investor. Ingrid is a cautious, risk-averse retail investor. She reads the fine print. She needs things explained clearly.
She definitely doesn't have a background in high finance.
Not at all. She is exactly who FINRA is waking up every morning trying to protect from people like Riley.
She represents the general public, basically.
Yeah.
The baseline of vulnerability in the financial markets.
Yeah. And finally, we have Sam the Sponsor. Sam is a heavy-hitting institutional investor. He manages a massive $60 million entity.
A true whale.
Oh, yeah. He expects high-level data. He understands complex risks, derivatives, liquidity constraints. He absolutely does not need his hand held.
Sam is playing a completely different game. He has lawyers and analysts on speed dial. FINRA knows Sam can fend for himself, so the rules for him are, well, different.
Right. So we have Riley, Ingrid, and Sam. Keep them in your head. Let's start with the most foundational concept of this entire regulatory framework. The three buckets.
The buckets are everything.
Every single piece of communication that Riley the Rep sends out, whether it's a glossy brochure, an email, a text message, or, I don't know, a tweet, it falls into one of three distinct buckets.
Always.
It is either correspondence, a retail communication, or an institutional communication.
And the bucket a piece of paper or digital message falls into completely dictates its regulatory destiny.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning the entire burden of who has to approve it. Whether you have to mail a copy to the regulators, how long you have to store it on a server, it all changes instantly depending on which of those three buckets it lands in.
Okay, let's tackle the first two buckets together, because they are basically twins separated by a very specific line in the sand. Correspondence versus retail communications.
Right.
I call this the numbers game. If I'm Riley, how do I know if the email I just drafted is correspondence or retail?
You count the recipients, that's it. The magic number is 25.
25?
Yeah. Correspondence is defined by FINRA as any written or electronic communication distributed or made available to 25 or fewer retail investors within any 30 calendar day period.
Okay, so 25 Ingrids. As long as Riley is sending this to 25 or fewer people like Ingrid, he's safe in the correspondence bucket.
That is the threshold. But the moment he distributes that piece to more than 25 retail investors, So the 26th Ingrid in that same 30-day window, the email is no longer correspondence.
It just changes.
It instantly mutates into a retail communication, and that retail bucket carries vastly stricter approval standards.
I want you to think about the mechanics of this for a second. Let's do a scenario. You're looking at the exam. Riley, the rep, sends an identical email pitch to exactly 25 different Ingrids on May 1st.
Okay, right at the limit.
Right at the absolute limit of the correspondence bucket. Now, let's say a few weeks pass. On May 29th, he meets one more retail investor, a 26th Ingrid. He opens his sent folder, finds that May 1st email, and forwards it to her. What just happened?
Well, he just walked right into one of the most common of violations in the industry.
Wait, really? Just from forwarding an email?
Yeah, that exact same email pitch, without a single comma or period being changed, just transformed from correspondence into a retail communication.
Because he hit 26 people.
Exactly.
But wait, hold on. I want to clarify the timeline here, because I see people get this wrong all the time in practice questions. Riley sent the first batch on May 1st. He sent the extra one on May 29th. The rule says within any 30 calendar day period.
Right.
Is that just a calendar month? Like, does June 1st just magically wipe the slate clean?
This is a huge trap. This is where careers get derailed. It is a rolling 30-day window. It is absolutely not a calendar month.
Oh, wow.
The regulators do not care if the month changes. The exam will definitely give you a scenario where Riley sends 20 emails on April 28th and then 10 more of the exact same email on May 5th.
And Riley is sitting at his desk thinking, hey, new month. May 1st resets the clock. I'm totally fine.
And Riley is completely wrong. You have to count back 30 calendar days from whatever today is.
So it's always moving.
Always moving. If today is May 5th, April 28th is well within that 30-day rearview mirror. So 20 plus 10 is 30. He has hit 30 retail investors in a rolling 30-day window.
He crossed the 25-person threshold.
Yep. And he just created an unapproved retail communication, which is a massive compliance breach. Every single time he hits send, he has to mentally look backward 30 days and tally up how many retail investors have seen that specific message.
Man, that's stressful. Think of it like a bouncer at a nightclub. Imagine a club, and the local fire marshal has set a strict, absolute capacity of 25 people.
Okay, I like this.
That small, chill environment is your correspondence bucket. You don't need a massive security team, the rules are pretty relaxed, and the manager doesn't need to hover over the floor. But the second person, number 26, walks through that door, the building is suddenly legally reclassified as a major event venue.
Right. The vibe totally changes.
It's the same building, the same music, the same drinks. But because of the audience size, you suddenly need different fire exits. You need a manager on duty to sign off on everything. And you need a direct line to the city inspectors.
That analogy captures the Finora philosophy perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
The email itself didn't change, just like the physical building didn't change. But the size of the audience changed the risk profile.
The risk of it going wrong at scale.
Exactly. Finora's logic is that if you are talking to 25 or fewer people over a month, you're having a conversation.
Yes.
You're communicating individually. But if you are talking to more than 25 retail investors with the exact same message, you are no longer conversing. You are broadcasting.
You're running a marketing campaign.
You are. And if you're going to broadcast to the general public, Finora is going to regulate you like a broadcaster to make sure you aren't spreading misleading information at scale.
Okay, so correspondence is 25 or fewer retail investors looking backward on a rolling 30-day clock. Retail communication is 26 or more in that same window. That leaves our third bucket, the VIP lounge, institutional communications.
My favorite bucket. Institutional communications are defined by one word, and that word is only. They are distributed only to institutional investors.
So there's no retail threshold at all?
None. You could send an institutional communication to 10,000 institutional investors on a Tuesday, and it remains an institutional communication. The volume doesn't matter, only the audience.
Wow.
But, and this is a big but, if even one retail investor is intentionally included on that email chain, the whole thing gets dragged out of the VIP lounge and reclassified into the correspondence or retail buckets.
Just one Ingrid ruins the party.
Pretty much.
That makes the definition of who gets into the VIP lounge incredibly important. Who exactly is Sam the sponsor? Like, if I run into a guy at a golf course who is wearing a Rolex and drives a Ferrari, can I just assume he's an institutional investor?
You absolutely cannot guess. Finora has a strictly closed list. If the entity doesn't fit into one of these predefined categories, they are retail. End of story.
So who is on the list?
Sam the sponsor has to be something like a bank, a savings and loan association, an insurance company, or a registered investment company, which usually just means a mutual fund.
Okay, mostly big financial entities.
Right. It also includes government entities and registered broker-dealers or their registered representatives.
But what about the guy on the golf course? A very, very wealthy individual, if Sam isn't at a bank, but just a phenomenally rich person.
A natural person, like an individual human being, can qualify as an institutional investor, but the bar is staggeringly high.
How high?
They must have total assets of at least $50
million. $50
million? Not $1 million, not $5 million, $50 million in total assets.
Notice the phrasing there, though. $50 million in total assets, not net worth. Why does Finer Array specify total assets instead of net worth? Usually when we talk about wealth and finance, we care about what you actually own free and clear.
Because the institutional definition isn't just about financial cushioning. It's about scale and sophistication.
Ah, I see.
If an individual or an entity controls $50 million in total assets, even if they have $40 million in liabilities, they are managing a massive, complex balance sheet.
That makes sense. They're playing in the big leagues.
Exactly. They are engaging with the financial system at a level that necessitates professional lawyers, accountants, and advisors. Finera just assumes that anyone juggling a $50 million asset pool has the infrastructure to analyze a pitch deck without needing the regulator to hold their hand.
Okay, let's talk about retirement plans, because this is a classic scenario where candidates get super confused. How do employee benefit plans, like a 403b for teachers or a 457 plan for municipal workers, fit into this institutional definition?
An employee benefit plan can absolutely be considered an institutional investor, but it must hit a specific size metric. The plan itself must have at least 100 participants in the aggregate.
Okay, so if a local hospital has a retirement plan with 150 nurses participating, the plan itself is an institutional investor.
Exactly. The hospital's plan administrator, the actual investment committee making the decisions for that huge pool of money, is treated like Sam the sponsor.
Okay, let's paint a scenario. Riley the rep is at a neighborhood barbecue, he's flipping burgers, and he starts talking to a middle school history teacher.
I can already see where this is going.
The teacher says, yeah, I invest every month into my school district's 403b plan, and there are definitely over 500 teachers in the district using it. Riley does some mental math. 403b plan. Check. Over 100 participants. Check. So, on Monday morning, Riley sends this history teacher a highly complex, jargon-heavy institutional pitch deck for a highly illiquid private real estate offering, treating him exactly like he would treat Sam the sponsor.
And Riley's going to lose his license.
Really? Just like that?
Oh, yeah. He completely blurred the line between the entity and the individual. Being a participant in a massive retirement plan does not confer institutional status onto the employee.
Oh, so the teacher is still just a teacher.
Right. The institutional status belongs to the plan itself. The committee managing the 403B is institutional. The history teacher, unless he secretly has $50 million in personal assets hidden under his mattress, is Ingrid the investor.
He is retail.
He is 100% retail. Riley treated a retail investor to unregulated institutional-grade marketing, which is a massive violation.
The status doesn't trickle down. I love that. So institutional is banks, governments, $50 million entities or individuals, and 100-plus participant retirement plans.
You got it.
But let's look at a scenario where things go wrong organically. Not because Riley was being reckless. What if Riley does everything perfectly?
Where but possible.
He verifies Sam the sponsor manages a $60 million fund. He sends Sam a highly complex institutional deck. It's totally compliant. But Sam reads it, thinks it's interesting, and without asking, he forwards the email to his niece Ingrid, who is a college student with $300 to her name.
Oh boy.
Riley just sent an institutional communication that landed in the inbox of a retail investor. Does he get fired for that?
This brings up the concept of strict liability versus intent. It's known in the industry as the unexpected leak rule.
The unexpected leak?
Yeah. Finer regulators aren't entirely unreasonable. They know that once an email leaves a broker-dealer's outbox, the firm cannot control it forever. They literally cannot physically stop a client from hitting the forward button.
Right. They can't police Sam's computer.
Exactly. So Finrod judges the firm on what it had reason to believe when it distributed the piece.
Reason to believe? That sounds like a very specific legal defense.
It is. The regulator will ask, did Riley have any reason to believe that Sam was going to forward that deck to retail investors? If the answer is no, if it was a true unexpected leak by a third party, then the piece does not retroactively become a retail communication.
Oh, that's a relief.
Right. Riley and the firm will not be sanctioned for Sam's independent action.
But what if, I don't know, what if the deck had a giant flashing button on the final page that said, share this exciting opportunity with your friends and family?
Well, then the defense falls apart completely.
Because he asked for it.
Right. Riley absolutely had reason to believe the document would be forwarded to retail investors. He literally encouraged it. In that case, the firm would be judged as having distributed a retail communication disguised as an institutional one.
Sneaky.
And because they didn't get it approved as a retail communication, they are facing severe penalties. The test on the exam is always going to be, what did the firm know, or what should they have reasonably expected at the exact moment of distribution?
Okay, so we've got the buckets figured out. We know how to count the 25 Ingrids on a rolling 30-day clock. We know who gets into the VIP lounge, and we know what happens if something leaks out of the lounge.
The foundation is set.
But categorizing an email into a bucket doesn't mean you can just write whatever you want, right? This brings us to the content itself. What is Riley actually allowed to say?
This is crucial. The rules governing what you can say are called the content standards. And the most vital thing to understand is that they apply universally.
Universally, meaning all the buckets.
It does not matter if a communication is correspondence, retail, or institutional. It doesn't matter if it's a quick text message to one person, an email blast to 10,000, or a leather-bound pitch deck handed to a sovereign wealth fund. The content standards apply.
No exceptions.
None. Skipping a filing requirement or an approval requirement does not give you permission to lie to people.
It sounds obvious when we say it out loud, but I know people get tripped up on this. They think, well, it's an institutional communication. Sam, the sponsor, is a pro, and I don't have to file this with FINRA, so I don't have to worry about the fair and balanced roles.
And that's exactly how people fail the Series 82.
Yeah.
Every single communication must be based on principles of fair dealing and good faith. It must provide a sound basis for evaluating the investment.
Right.
You cannot omit a material fact if leaving it out makes the rest of the communication misleading. And you absolutely cannot make false, exaggerated, unwarranted, or promissory statements.
So Riley can't put a headline that says, this private equity fund is a guaranteed rocket ship to early retirement?
Yeah, no guarantees, no exaggerated claims.
Yeah.
But the nuance here is really fascinating because fair and balanced isn't a rigid one-size-fits-all template.
What do you mean?
Well, FINRA requires a balanced treatment of risks and potential benefits, but the rule explicitly states that this must be done with details and explanations appropriate to the audience receiving the communication.
Appropriate to the audience. Okay, let's bring back Ingrid and Sam to test this out.
Perfect. So if Riley is pitching a complex derivative structure to Sam, the sponsor, Sam needs a specific type of information to understand the risk. Riley might just include a table of mathematical risk factors, you know, duration metrics, convexity.
Just the raw math.
Yeah. Sam has a team of quantitative analysts. He knows exactly what those numbers mean. Providing just the raw data is completely appropriate for that audience.
But if Riley takes that exact same pitch, the exact same table, and sends it to Ingrid the investor,
then the communication is suddenly non-compliant and misleading.
Even though the data is the same.
Because Ingrid does not know what convexity means. If he sends it to Ingrid, he needs to provide vastly more baseline explanation. He has to explain how those abstract risk factors could practically result in her losing her life savings.
Got it.
What counts as appropriate detail scales inversely with the sophistication of the audience. The less sophisticated the audience, the more explanatory detail you must provide.
It is like selling a car. If you are selling a sports car to a professional mechanic, let's call him Sam the sponsor, you can just hand him the raw spec sheet. He reads no ABS and instantly knows the car doesn't have an anti-lock braking system.
Right, he doesn't need a lecture on it.
He knows exactly how that changes the stopping distance in the rain. But if you are selling that exact same car to an 18-year-old kid buying their first vehicle, Ingrid, you can't just hand her the acronyms on a spec sheet and assume she's informed.
Not at all.
You have to explicitly tell her, hey, if you slam on these brakes on a wet road, the wheels will lock up and you will slide into a ditch.
That is precisely how FINRA views disclosure. You cannot bury material risks in a microscopic footnote on page 40 of a prospectus and assume a retail investor will piece it together.
They won't.
The rule clearly states you can only place information in a legend or a footnote if it doesn't get in the way of the investor actually understanding the communication. You can't use footnotes to hide the bad news.
So we have to be fair, balanced, and tailor our explanations to the audience. Let's talk about the ultimate taboo in finance marketing. The thing that will get Riley fired faster than almost anything else.
Oh, predicting performance.
Exactly, predicting performance.
The general rule is incredibly strict. You cannot project or predict performance, and you cannot imply that past results will recur.
So I want you to think about this scenario, listener. Riley sends a quick email to Ingrid. He says, "Hey, Ingrid, our flagship private fund returned 10% last year, so we are completely locked in to deliver another 10% this year. Let's get your capital deployed."
I cringe just hearing that.
Is he allowed to say that? Obviously not, right?
He is absolutely not allowed to say that. That is a blatant prediction.
Yay.
Human psychology is deeply wired to chase past returns. If we see a line going up, our brains assume it will keep going up.
It's just human nature.
Right. And Fianna knows this, and they are trying to protect investors from their own psychological biases and, frankly, their own greed. You cannot promise the future.
But the regulators aren't going to test you on a blatant, obvious lie like Riley's email on the actual exam. That's way too easy.
No, they're going to test you on the exceptions to the rule.
Right. There are three very narrow, very specific carve-outs where forward-looking math is actually legally permitted.
Yes. And you must know the difference between a prohibited prediction and a permitted illustration.
Okay, what's carve-out number one?
Carve-out number one is a hypothetical illustration of mathematical principles.
Break that down for it. What does illustrating a mathematical principle actually look like in a brochure?
It means math itself is objective. If you show a chart that says, if you invest $1,000 and it grows at a hypothetical compounded rate of 5% for 10 years, you will end up with X amount.
Just standard compounding math.
Right. That is perfectly legal. Why? Because it does not predict the performance of a specific actual investment product. You are simply teaching the client how compounding interest works.
Oh, I see. So demonstrating the magic of compound math is okay. Promising that your specific mutual fund will deliver that magic is illegal.
Exactly. You are teaching a concept, not selling a guaranteed outcome.
Okay, what's exception number two?
Exception number two is compliant investment analysis tools and the written reports those tools produce.
Okay, this feels like a massive trap for the exam. Explain what an investment analysis tool is in the real world.
Think of a Monte Carlo simulator, which is a software program used heavily in retirement planning.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of that.
It takes an investor's inputs, their current savings, their desired retirement age, their spending goals, and it simulates 10,000 possible market scenarios based on historical volatility.
So it runs a ton of math.
Tons of it. And then it spits out a statistical probability. It will tell Ingrid, based on these simulations, there is an 80% chance your portfolio will survive your retirement without running out of money.
Wait, hold on a second. Didn't we just establish that you cannot predict performance? Telling Ingrid she has an 80% chance of her portfolio surviving sounds exactly like predicting the future performance of her portfolio.
And that contradiction is exactly what the exam will test you on.
The
question will describe an investment analysis tool generating a future probability, and it will ask, is this a violation of the ban on predicting performance?
And what's the answer?
The answer is no. It is a specific, heavily regulated carve-out. Fianna allows these software tools because they are based on objective statistical models, not a salesman's gut feeling.
That makes sense.
And more importantly, they're required to come with heavy, standardized disclosures, clarifying that these are just statistical probabilities, not guarantees of future wealth.
So if you see a regulated software tool generating a probability, it's carve-out number two. Do not mark it as a violation.
Exactly.
Okay, what is the third and final exception to the no prediction rule?
A properly supported price target in a research report on debt or equity securities.
Meaning what?
If a firm's research department publishes a report saying they believe a specific tech stock will hit $50 a share in the next 12 months, that is technically a forward-looking prediction.
Right.
But it is allowed, provided the target has a reasonable basis, in fact, and is accompanied by all the required valuation methodologies and risk disclosures. It has to be a real, robust research report.
Let's summarize these golden rules before we move on.
Yeah.
Don't lie. Don't hide the risks in the fine print where Ingrid can't understand them. And never predict the future unless you are teaching a math concept using a regulated software simulator or publishing a fully supported institutional-grade research report.
That covers the content. But having a perfectly clean, compliant pitch deck isn't the end of the story.
It never is.
Fenrodroa doesn't just trust that Riley wrote a good email. The firm has to prove they are actively monitoring and authorizing this material.
Which brings us to principal approval requirements, the internal mother may I of the Brookrich firm. Riley has drafted his email. It's fair, it's balanced, there are no illegal predictions. Can he hit send, or does someone need to look over his shoulder first?
This is where those three buckets from the very beginning, correspondence, retail, and institutional, come back into play with a vengeance.
The buckets return.
The approval requirements map directly onto those categories. Because retail communications reach the widest, most vulnerable audience, they get the strictest supervisory treatment.
What is the exact rule for approving retail communications?
An appropriately qualified registered principal, which usually means Riley's branch manager or compliance officer, must approve each and every retail communication before the earlier of its first use or its filing with Fine and R.
The earlier of its first use or its filing, that phrasing is a classic regulatory headache.
It's very dense.
Let's build a timeline to unpack this for the listener. Riley drafts a glossy retail marketing brochure on Monday. The firm plans to put it in the mail to 100 retail investors on Friday.
Okay, Friday is first use.
Right. However, the compliance department decides to voluntarily file a copy of this brochure with FINR on Tuesday. So, when does Riley's boss need to formally sign off and approve the brochure?
Before Tuesday. It is whichever event happens first in chronological order.
See, people taking the exam often rationalize this incorrectly. They think, well, the public doesn't actually see it until Friday, so the boss has until Thursday night to review and approve it. Right.
Wrong. So wrong. If it goes to the regulator on Tuesday, the principal must have already approved it. FINRA does not want CIRMs submitting unapproved rough drafts to their department. They only want to see the final, internally vetted, principal-approved version.
Whichever comes first. Sending it to Ingrid or sending it to FINR?
Exactly.
But is the boss literally reading every single piece of retail communication? A large firm might generate thousands of pieces of retail material a week. Are there any exceptions to this prior approval rule?
There are a few narrow exceptions to prior pre-approval for retail pieces, designed basically to keep business moving. For instance, if a piece is posted on an online interactive electronic forum, think of a live chat room, a Reddit AMA, or a Twitter comment thread, it doesn't need prior approval because the medium requires spontaneity.
You can't ask your boss to review every tweet reply.
Right. However, it must be supervised heavily after the fact. Another exception is if the retail communication makes absolutely no financial or investment recommendation and promotes none of the firm's products or services.
So if Riley sends out a mass email saying Happy Thanksgiving from all of us at XYZ Brokerage, he doesn't need his boss to review the picture of the turkey.
Exactly. But the most highly testable exception on the exam is the piggyback rule.
The piggyback rule. Okay, how does that work?
If another member firm already filed the exact same piece of retail communication with FINRA, and they received a letter back from FINRA saying it appears consistent with the rules and your firm has not altered it in any way, you can piggyback on their approval.
You don't need your principal to reapprove an unaltered piece that FINRA has already blessed.
Precisely.
That makes sense for retail. It's strict. But what about institutional communications and correspondence? Does Riley have to run to his boss's desk for a signature every single time he wants to email Sam the sponsor or send a quick text to three clients?
No, and this is a massive operational relief for the financial industry. Institutional communications and correspondence do not require per piece prior approval by a principal.
Hey, I need to push back on this. If there's no pre-approval required, does that mean Riley can just blast out highly technical institutional emails to Sam the sponsor with zero oversight? Like, it's just the Wild West as long as the audience is institutional.
It is definitely not the Wild West. It is governed by a completely different regulatory philosophy.
Okay, how so?
Instead of item-by-item pre-approval, these buckets are governed by the firm's written supervisory procedures, or WSPs.
Why the different philosophy, though? Why does FINRA let them get away without pre-approval for these buckets?
Because it's about systemic trust versus micromanagement. FINRA recognizes that requiring a branch manager to read every single one-on-one email correspondence or every single 50-page technical institutional update would literally grind the modern financial system to a halt.
True, the volume is just too high.
The volume is insane, and the risk, especially with institutional investors, is just lower. So FINRA says, we won't force your boss to read everything before it goes out, but you must have a robust system in place to catch bad behavior.
What does that system actually look like in practice?
If a firm chooses not to require prior approval for institutional communications, their written supervisory procedures must mandate three specific pillars.
Okay, what are they?
Pillar one, education and training. The firm must train reps like Riley on exactly what they can and cannot say. Pillar 2, documentation. The firm must keep records proving that Riley actually attended and completed that training.
Got it. And pillar 3?
Pillar 3 is surveillance and follow-up.
Surveillance. So the boss isn't reading the email on Monday before it goes out, but they might spot check it on Friday after it went out.
Precisely. The compliance department might run an algorithm that flags certain keywords in Riley's emails, or they might review a random 10% sample of his institutional communications every month to ensure he's following the rules he was trained on.
Ah, so it is post-use review rather than pre-use approval.
Right.
Okay, so Riley's retail brochure has been approved by his boss. The internal hurdle is cleared. Now we have to look outward. Does he need to send a copy of this brochure to the regulators?
This brings us to the filing requirements.
Right, specifically interacting with Finarize Advertising Regulation Department.
The most important thing to grasp here is that filing is a completely separate legal obligation from principal approval.
People definitely mix those up.
They do. Do not mix them up in your head. Almost all retail communications need internal principal approval, but only a specific subset actually needs to be filed with FINR.
Let's start with the rookies. How does FINRA treat a brand new broker-dealer that just opened its doors?
With a healthy dose of suspicion, honestly, FINRA operates under a new member rule. For the first year of a firm's FINRA membership, they must file any retail communication published in electronic or other public media at least 10 business days before first use.
10 days before. So they literally have to file it, sit on their hands, and wait for 2 weeks before they can put the ad on the internet or mail it out.
Yes. FINRA wants to thoroughly inspect the marketing habits of new firms before their advertising can do any damage to the public.
Let me clarify a nuance here. What if Riley is a 20-year veteran of the industry? He has a spotless compliance record, he knows the rules inside and out, but he decides to change jobs and join a brand new startup broker-dealer.
Okay, I see where you're going.
Is Riley subjected to the rookie rules even though he's a veteran?
Yes, absolutely. The regulatory clock is attached to the firm, not the individual rep.
So Riley's experience doesn't matter.
Not to FINRA. The one-year window begins on the date reflected in the firm's CRD, the Central Registration Depository, as the date their FINRA membership became effective. Riley's personal hire date, or his 2 decades of experience, are irrelevant. The firm is new, therefore the firm is subject to the 10-day pre-filing rule for its retail media.
What happens after the firm celebrates its first birthday and graduates from the rookie rules? They have a track record now.
Outside that new member window, the filing timing depends entirely on the content of the retail communication itself. There are 2 distinct timelines you have to memorize for the exam.
What are they?
Before first use and within 10 business days of first use.
Those sound very similar, but they dictate entirely different workflows.
It is a massive directional difference, and the exam will test your understanding of both. At least 10 business days before first use means exactly what the rookie rule meant. You file it and you wait. You cannot distribute it yet.
What kind of stuff falls under that?
This applies to things that are inherently riskier or more complex for retail investors to understand, like retail communications regarding certain custom fund performance rankings or security futures.
And the other timeline?
Within 10 business days of first use. This means Riley can hit send or publish the ad on Monday, and as long as FINRA receives the file by the following week, the firm is fully compliant.
So you don't have to wait.
Right. The marketing piece gets to go out into the real world before FINRA necessarily lays eyes on it. This looser timeline applies to things like standard mutual fund promotions or publicly offered direct participation programs, also known as DPPs.
So before means stop and wait. Within means execute now. File soon.
Exactly.
But we've only talked about what goes into the FINRA inbox. What is explicitly excluded? What does FINRA actively not want you to send them?
FINRA does not want to drown in useless paperwork.
Yeah.
So they categorically exclude correspondence. Never file correspondence.
And institutional communications.
Excluded. Never file those either.
What else makes the exclusion list?
Press releases that are made available only to members of the media. Prospectuses that have already been filed with the SEC because, well, the SEC already has them. FINRA doesn't need a duplicate copy cluttering their system.
Makes sense.
And, crucially, for anyone taking the Series 82, the offering documents for exempt offerings, this means documents like a private placement memorandum or PPM, are excluded from routine filing.
Okay, this is where things get incredibly dangerous for test takers and for real-world reps. I want you to pay close attention to this interaction between the filing rules and the content rules we discussed earlier.
It is the ultimate blind spot. Exclusion from filing is not immunity from the content standards. I cannot stress this enough.
Let's run a scenario to show how someone ruins their career over this. Riley, the rep, is working on a private placement. He's writing the private placement memorandum, the PPM.
Oh.
He remembers his Series 82 training. He says to himself, exempt offerings like PPMs are excluded from filing with the Advertising Regulation Department. So because he knows he doesn't have to mail a copy to FineArray, Riley decides to go wild.
This is a terrible idea.
He puts massive, unwarranted performance predictions in the PPM. He promises a 20% return. He hides all the liquidity risks in microscopic, unreadable font. He thinks FINRA isn't going to read this anyway, so the rules don't apply.
And Riley is going to face catastrophic disciplinary action.
But they didn't ask him to file it.
It doesn't matter. Just because a document doesn't go to the Advertising Regulation Department as a mandatory, routine filing does not excuse it from the fair, balanced, and truthful requirements.
Right.
FINRA retains the right to call in that PPM under a spot check procedure. If they run a routine audit and discover that Riley lied in a document simply because it was excluded from routine filing, the penalties will be severe. The content standards apply to absolutely everything a broker-dealer produces.
Exempt from filing does not mean exempt from the truth. That is such a critical distinction. And speaking of PPMs and exempt offerings, how does all this communication theory apply when we are actually dealing with private offerings versus public ones?
This is where it gets really real.
Because the Series 82 is literally the private securities offerings exam, this is where the rubber meets the road.
Exactly. This is exactly where the communication rules we just spent time dissecting crash headfirst into the Series 82, offering exemptions that you learn elsewhere in your studies.
Let's establish the baseline. How do we market a public deal, like an offering that has gone through the full, grueling SEC registration process?
A publicly registered offering gets full, unrestricted access to all three communication buckets.
Nice.
You can use correspondence, you can use institutional communications, and most importantly, you can use retail communications to blast the offering out to the general public.
Public deals are like a billboard in Times Square. As long as the billboard meets the fair and balanced content standards, and as long as the branch manager approved it, you can shout it from the rooftops. Anyone walking by can look at it.
Exactly. The sheer volume of marketing is not restricted for a public deal.
But what about a private placement? Specifically, a standard private placement operating under the traditional rules, often referred to as a no solicitation deal.
General advertising or broad solicitation is completely 100% incompatible with a standard private placement.
Why? Why can't Riley put up a Times Square billboard for a private equity fund if the billboard is honest and balanced?
You have to think about the fundamental nature of a private offering. Why does it exist?
Mm.
A private offering is allowed to skip the incredibly expensive, time-consuming process of SEC registration, specifically because it promises to stay out of the public eye.
Oh, the secrecy is the point.
Right. It is a regulatory exemption based entirely on secrecy and approaching a limited number of targeted, sophisticated investors with whom you have a pre-existing relationship.
So if you advertise it broadly...
If you advertise it on a billboard, or if Riley runs a sponsored ad on Facebook,
right.
You blow up the very exemption you were relying on. You are essentially telling the SEC, hey, we are a quiet, private deal, while simultaneously screaming about it on the internet. The regulators will instantly strip away your private exemption, reclassify the deal as an illegal, unregistered public offering, and shut the whole thing down. You cannot generally advertise a standard private placement.
But wait, the industry is evolving. Isn't there a relatively newer rule that provides a plot twist here, like a way to actually advertise a private deal?
Yes, there is. It's often referred to as the accredited-only exemption, specifically Rule 506C of Regulation D.
506C, okay.
Under this specific rule, an issuer can choose a different path. They can say to the SEC, we want to advertise this deal broadly. We want to use social media. We want to run ads. But in exchange for that right to advertise, we promise that every single person who actually purchases this security will be a verified, accredited investor.
So you trade secrecy for exclusivity. You can show the ad to everyone, but you can only take money from the rich.
Exactly. So let's look at Riley.
Yeah.
He wants to run a Facebook ad for a new private real estate syndicate.
Oh.
If his firm is running a standard no solicitation private placement and Riley runs that ad, he is fired. He just ruined the legal exemption for the whole fund.
Yikes.
But if the firm explicitly structured the deal under the accredited-only exemption from the start, then Riley can run the ad. Subject, of course, to all the fair and balanced content rules and printable approval rules we already discussed.
So the boundary of your marketing follows the specific legal exemption of the deal, not just the generic label of private offering.
Perfectly stated.
Yeah.
You have to know the specific exemption.
I want to cover one more classic trap in this section before I move on. The tombstone ad. I see this constantly in practice questions. What exactly is a tombstone and how do test takers get tricked by it?
A tombstone is a very dry, factual, backward-looking announcement stating that a member firm participated in a private placement.
Okay, so it's after the fact.
Right, it's essentially a matter of public record.
Yeah.
They'll say something like, XYZ Brokerage successfully placed $20 million for ABC Company.
Why is it called a tombstone?
It's called a tombstone because historically, these announcements were printed in financial newspapers, and they featured a stark black border with just the basic facts, making them look like literal tombstones. That's a little morbid, but okay. And earlier, when we were listing things that Finrod doesn't want in their inbox, we learned that these tombstone announcements are excluded from filing requirements, right? Yes, tombstones are excluded from Finrod filing. And here is where the trap snaps shut. The exam will give you a scenario. They'll say, since the tombstone announcement for this private deal is excluded from Finrod filing, does this mean the underlying private offering can now be marketed publicly?
Think about the logic there, listener. Does a filing exclusion for a tiny printed announcement magically unlock public marketing for a secretive private deal?
Absolutely not. The exclusion is just for the piece of paper announcing the deal is already done. It's not backdoor permission to suddenly market a private, no solicitation offering to the general public.
They're unrelated.
Completely. Do not confuse a simple FINRA filing exclusion with a massive exemption from the Securities Act of 1933. They are two entirely different legal concepts.
Okay, so we've run the deal. We've navigated the minefield of public versus private marketing. We sent the emails. We got the branch manager to sign off. We filed what needed filing. When the dust finally settles on a transaction, how long do we have to hold on to the receipts?
The fun part, record keeping.
Because if there is one thing FINRA loves more than rules, it's a paper trail. Let's talk record keeping.
The core concept here is the oldest rule in the compliance profession. If it isn't documented, it didn't happen. FINRA doesn't just trust that you followed the rules today. You have to be able to prove it to an auditor 3 years from now.
Let's talk about those timeframes. How long are we keeping these files?
The overarching rule is 3 years total, but there's a crucial sub-rule. For the first 2 years, those records must be kept in an easily accessible place.
Okay, wait. Does this three-year clock just apply to the highly regulated retail communications? Because we said correspondence doesn't need to be filed, does it still need to be saved?
It applies to all of them. Retail, institutional, and correspondence all share this exact same three-year retention clock.
Wow, even the small stuff.
Yep. It doesn't matter that correspondence skip the FINRA inbox and bypass the prior principal approval. You still have to keep a perfect record of it for 3 years.
What does easily accessible actually mean in physical reality?
Well, decades ago, it literally meant the physical filing cabinet next to the compliance officer's desk, as opposed to a dusty warehouse across town where old files went to die.
Right, taking days to find something.
Exactly. Today, it generally means immediately retrievable cloud storage or active servers, usually in a WORM-compliant format. Right. Once, read many, meaning the files can't be altered or deleted.
So they're locked in.
They're locked. If FINRA knocks on the firm's door during year one or two, they expect to see that document pulled up on a screen almost instantly. By year three, it could be moved to deeper, archived, cold storage.
And what exactly goes into this digital file? Just the email itself?
No, it has to be a robust, complete record. It must include a copy of the communication itself. It needs the dates of its first use and the day of its last use, if applicable. And crucially, it needs the name of the approving principal and the date they officially gave their approval.
But wait, we established earlier that institutional communications and correspondence don't always have a prior approving principal. If no boss signed off on it, what goes in the file to satisfy the record-keeping rule?
Good catch. If the piece was not approved before first use, like a standard institutional email sent under a firm's WSPS, the record must instead name the person who prepared or distributed it.
Ah, so Riley's name goes on the file.
Yes. FINRA needs to know exactly whose neck to ring if they pull that file 2 years later and find a violation. Accountability is paramount.
That makes sense. What else goes in the record? I've seen a concept floating around called the source rule.
The source rule is vital. You must include the source of any statistical table, chart, graph, or other illustration used in the communication. You cannot just invent numbers to make a pitch look better.
Let's go back to our favorite reckless rep. Riley draws a literal picture of a rocket ship going straight up, slaps some impressive-looking numbers on the y-axis, and puts it in an institutional pitch deck.
A classic Riley move.
6 months later, the compliance officer is doing an audit. They pull the file and ask, Riley, what is the source for this statistical projection? And Riley says, I made it up. Source. Trust me.
And FARI auditors would have an absolute field day with that. The record must trace any statistical illustration back to its legitimate origin. If you quote a GDP growth chart to prove a macroeconomic point, you better have a note in the file saying it came from the Bureau of Economic Analysis on this specific date.
You have to prove it.
Sourcing is not optional, and it is heavily tested because it prevents reps from fabricating data.
Are there any record-keeping requirements that are specific only to retail communications?
Yes. Remember earlier we talked about the piggyback rule, how a firm can avoid prior principal approval on a retail piece if they use a piece that another member firm already filed and got approved.
Yeah, if the piece is unaltered.
If you rely on that exception, your record must include the actual FINRA review letter from that other member. You have to prove you actually had permission to piggyback.
Got it.
Additionally, if a retail communication uses any performance ranking of a registered investment company, a copy of that ranking must be included in the file. Neither of those specific documentation requirements applies to institutional pieces.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground. From counting to 25 to the earlier of approval rules to the nuances of public versus private marketing, I want to pull this all together. Let's trace Riley the rep through a single complex transaction to rapidly recap how these rules stack on top of each other.
Let's do it. Walk me through his week.
It's Monday morning. Riley has a new private placement deal to sell. It's a standard, no solicitation, Reg D offering. First thing he does is draft an email. He sends it to 20 cautious retail investors. 20 Ingrids. What bucket is he in and what are his rules?
He sent it to 20 retail investors, which is under the 25-person threshold. So he is in the correspondence bucket.
Okay, and what does that mean for him?
Because it's correspondence, he does not need prior principal approval. And he does not need to file it with FINRA. He just needs to follow the firm's written supervisory procedures. And the content must be fair and balanced.
Tuesday morning, Riley is feeling ambitious. He drafts a highly technical deck and sends it to Sam the sponsor, our $60 million institutional whale, and three other massive banks.
He is now operating in the institutional communication bucket. The audience is purely institutional.
So what are the rules there?
Again, no prior principal approval required and absolutely no filing with FINRA.
Mm-hmm.
But he cannot predict performance and he must retain a record of that deck for 3 years, just like the correspondence.
Wednesday. Riley is getting desperate for capital. He goes back to his list of Ingrids. He selects 10 more retail investors who didn't get Monday's email, and he hits send on the exact same pitch.
The trap has been sprung.
Oh.
He said 20 on Monday and 10 on Wednesday. That is 30 retail investors within a rolling 30-day window. He has crossed the 25-person threshold.
So what is the email now?
But email just instantly became a retail communication. Because it's retail, his branch manager was required to approve it before he hit send on Wednesday. Since he didn't get that approval, he just committed a major compliance violation.
Thursday, the compliance officer catches Riley's mistake. To mitigate the damage, the compliance officer formally approves the piece and decides to voluntarily file it with FINRA's Advertising Regulation Department.
Because the firm is filing it, the timeline rule kicks in. Was the firm established less than a year ago? If so, they have to wait 10 days before using it again. If they're an established firm, they might just have to file it within 10 days of first use, depending on the specific product.
Friday, the regulators called the firm. They noticed that Riley's Wednesday email was pitching a standard, no solicitation private placement.
And the final shoe drops.
Yeah.
Because Riley effectively broadcasted the deal to 30 retail investors, he likely engaged in general solicitation.
Which means
he just blew up the private exemption for the entire offering.
Yeah.
The SEC could step in and halt the deal. Riley's firm is going to face massive fines, and Riley is going to be looking for a new career outside of finance.
That is the life cycle of how these rules interact. The threshold is 25 on a rolling 30 days. The content standards apply to absolutely everything. Retail needs prior approval. Institutional and correspondence run on WSPs. Filing exclusions do not excuse you from the truth, and you keep the receipts for 3 years.
That is the core of what you need to know to navigate this section of the Series 82.
It's a lot, but it makes sense when you put it together.
It does, but you know, if we connect this all to the bigger picture, all these rules we just spent an hour dissecting were fundamentally built in a world of physical mail, print brochures, and static websites.
Right, the old school way of doing things.
Think about how FINRA's rolling 30-day window, or the reason to believe standard for leaks, are going to be stress tested in the very near future.
What do you mean?
As AI-generated hyper-personalized video pitches start hitting retail investors' inboxes, how do you even define an identical retail communication when an AI algorithm is subtly changing the phrasing, the tone, and the examples for every single recipient based on their digital psychological profile?
Wow. If every single pitch is custom generated and technically unique, is it all just correspondence? Or is the algorithm itself considered a retail communication?
That is the regulatory nightmare on the horizon. The mediums are going to change drastically. The technology is going to outpace the current definitions of what a communication even is.
That's wild to think about.
But here is the anchor, and this is why understanding the why is so important. The mandate to be fair, balanced, and truthful. The core directive to not prey on an investor's lack of sophistication or their psychological biases, that is forever.
It doesn't matter what the tech is.
Exactly. If you understand why FINRA cares about Ingrid, you will always be able to navigate the spirit of the rules, no matter what new technology reps try to use to bend them.
That is a fascinating thought to end on. You don't just need to know the rules to pass the exam. You need to understand the intent behind them to survive a long career in the industry. Review those flashcards, keep an eye out for those rolling 30-day traps, and go crush your Series 82 exam.